comic book writer and friend of the podcast, Gabe Chang, is launching his Kickstarter campaign on Wednesday, March 16th. For the first time ever, all four issues of Gabe's comic For Molly will be published in a collected trade paperback. For Molly is an action-packed modern fantasy adventure set among the abandoned things in the New Jersey forest where talking dogs and off-the-grid humans have precariously coexisted. Until now. The story centers on an antisocial talking dog named Molly, who helps a recently divorced outsider named Greg save his sister from a hidden evil. It explores the themes of guilt, abandonment, and loyalty as Greg and Molly's unlikely friendship is tested on every step of their journey. For Molly features art by Benjamin Sawyer, and the 150-page trade paperback also contains a short story spinoff, Into the Wilderness, with art by Aliza Mengel. Click the link in the show notes to get your copy now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Indie Comic Spotlight, the show where we do a deep dive into an ongoing series or graphic novel from a company other than the big two. This is the best of the rest, and today I'm a publisher I've never covered on this show before, so I'm very excited. Once again, Hannah, thank you for making this happen. So many great interviews on the show have come way of Hannah over at Superfan. I'm a superfan of Hannah. So today I have a writer. Of a new book coming out. It's the beginning of a trilogy, and you'll hear all about it from him. So welcome to Indie Comic Spotlight, Richard Momsen. Richard, hello.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Oh man, I'm excited to have you here. You know, Hannah sends me all kinds of stuff. I wish I could say yes to everything Hannah did. Like if I didn't have a job, this is all like, if I got paid to do this, it would be like, yes, Hannah, this is all I'm going to do all day. She could keep me in business, just as many amazing interviews as she could set up. So this is very exciting because this is a totally different, book than I've covered on here before, but I've got takes. And so before we get into Bywater, which is the beginning of a trilogy from Plow, and we'll get to it. Let's get back in time. Nobody stumbles into becoming a comic book writer by accident. Like everybody who's like, nobody's like, what is this comic book medium? Everybody has a comic book origin story. So because you're new to the show, let's go back to Little Rich. There he is. What's your comic book origin story? How did you get into him? And then how did that turn into, what is your professional, you know, career trajectory that led you here to be scripting this book?
You mean like what the comics that I read as a kid?
Yeah, yeah. What's your origin story? Like for me, it was like the first one I ever bought was a Green Lantern. I was 12.
Okay. So I actually wasn't a big comic book kid. The closest I got was just being an avid consumer of Tintin, Hergé, which I don't know.
We
if
have
that
covered
really
him twice on the show. I've done two. I've got a friend of mine from New Zealand. He lives in the UK and we are going through Tintin little by little. So we've done two Tintin books so far.
Yeah. So I and my friends, I mean that we would just pour over those books. That and Asterix.
Sure. Covered Asterix on here too. You're singing my song, Rich. So, let's go. Yeah.
And those are, Asterix in particular is a comic book that's based in history, right?
Yeah, of course.
So that kind of naturally leads to what we ended up doing.
So let me stop for a second, because honestly, I'll be fair, like Tintin I knew, but I didn't know Asterix until very recently, until we covered him on the show. So how did you, like, I'm from Michigan, Asterix didn't make it there apparently. So how did you, unless you're from Michigan, you're like, what part of Michigan are you from? How did you find Asterix? How did that come to you?
So I have friends who grew up in England. They were the ones who introduced me to Asterix. Like, yeah, my American friends weren't familiar with the series at all. Once I got into Asterix, it was never turned back. And now my kids are reading them. So it's pretty neat.
So fun.
They stand the test of time.
Really do. Yeah. But like you said, that is also based in history and also a bit of a satire, which is, I think Asterix is hysterically funny. Yeah, I just think it's so good. Yeah. Cool. All right. So you were like, how old? Like you were like a tween?
Probably, yeah, 10, 12. That's probably when I did most of my comic book reading. And then after that, I haven't done so much.
Which is totally fair.
Until recently.
Yeah. Right.
So as I started researching for this book.
Yeah, talk about that. So this is about Felix. This is called By Water, and it's part of a trilogy about the Reformation. And this is Felix Mann. So it's based on a true story. Somebody, and I'm a history nerd. I'm an English teacher, but a history nerd. And I didn't know this guy. So it's fascinating. So I love to learn things. So I guess, how did you make it to this? How did you get to this project? What do you do? Like, are you a religious historian? How did this all work? How did Jason get you on this project?
So I've been friends with Jason for a long time, and he's sort of been marinating in this story for probably 25 years.
Yeah, his introduction to this is pretty powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an artist in his own right. My background sort of is in script writing for video, for YouTube, internet. I've done some plays, we did a version of the Odyssey based on Emily Wilson's most recent translation, which was a lot of fun. Did that with a bunch of kids. I've written a few film scripts. And so that's kind of my background with script writing. And Jason had this idea and was struggling to move it forward. So he asked me to come on board and sort of bring my skill set. He'd done most of the research. So I had benefit of a lot of the depth that he brought to the story. And so over the course of probably a year, we worked up the script, and then partnered with Sanka Banerjee, who's the artist. He's from Calcutta. So that was kind of a fun, and his background is very interesting. He's Hindu. So his art is mostly, that theme, Hindu gods. And so I think he brings some of that flavor to the art, which is pretty neat. And that's kind of how the collaboration came together.
Nice. I think that's fantastic too, that he's Hindu too, because this is obviously a story about Christianity, but it's also a conversation about the human side of Christianity, right? This isn't really a conversation about faith, although that's part of it. It's not a conversation of belief. You don't have to believe in Christianity or be a Christian or be, you could be an atheist. And there's something about this book, which we'll obviously get into, and we don't want to spoil because the book is just out. So we don't want to spoil anything, but I do think it's a fascinating character that Felix Mann's is. It's a fascinating story that you guys are telling. So he storied it, and then you were like, okay, I'll turn it into a comic script. But since you were a film script writer and video script writer, when you write scripts, normally do you think about the storyboard art? You've obviously worked with storyboarders. So like, was that an easy transition for you to like write a comic script, or did you have to learn a lot?
I had to learn some things, but, I really left a lot of it to Jason because he had so much of it in his head. He had so much of this. I mean, he'd visited the area, he'd visited with his family. He went over there and spent, several weeks just photographing and thinking. And then he did a lot, deep dive into the art of the period. So a lot of the art you're seeing is sort of based on, contemporary artists from that time a modern twist or something. So it doesn't feel like weird, people with funny hats, as you often think of with medieval art, right?
Sure. Although there are some definitely funny hats.
There are some funny hats.
Yeah, yeah.
But we wanted to make, we didn't want some sort of like, Prince Valiant type thing. We wanted to, make something that people could connect with the characters, because in the end, what we're talking about, the concerns these characters had are very contemporary concerns. The things that they were thinking about, freedom of conscience, a just society, not being subjugated to the powers that be. These are very contemporary concerns and stuff that I think will resonate with readers.
Yeah, I agree. I think what I found fascinating about the book is exactly that. Like, you're telling this story from what, the 1500s, and you're like, oh, well, this is happening now. There's always this whoever is in control, and this, there's a control issue in this book and in this and in religion and in the Reformation in general. Control is always part of the conversation, right? It's always like, I'm in control. And then when, Martin Luther banged his thing is onto the wall, he's like, now I'm in control. And then they're like, well, we don't like that, so we're going to splinter off. And, the Protestants, there's protests among the Protestants. And that's, you know, this book is about that too, because I find it so incredibly fascinating. Like, historically, we think, okay, there were Catholics, and then there was the Protestant Reformation, and then that was it. And then you're like, well, duh, there's like 15 Protestant sects, and like, they all don't get along. In your mind, you think that they do, but this book highlights that they don't. And so how much, my question to you, Rich, is how much history, like obviously Jason did the work, boy, did he do the work. And the art, honestly, like the map work, some of the imagery.
It's amazing.
I don't know how much time he spent on the map work, but it's like, I'm looking at some panels. I was like, well, he spent 16 years drawing this one page. How are they going to get this trilogy done in time? That's, I mean, it's mad skills. Like, how much did you learn? What did you bring? What did you know coming to this? Because it's fascinating too that your artist, Hindu, so this was in his wheelhouse. This was all new to him. And so I think that brings such a fresh perspective that he's bringing to it. There's no preconceived notion. So what were yours when you were writing the script? And then what was that process like, taking Jason's story and being like, well, I got to trust his history? Or I think while this is the facts that you've uncovered, Jason, as the script writer and as the story person who may not know it all, I feel like thematically, or the way to tell the story is to do this. I know it's a bunch of questions, but I just kind of wanted to see where you wanted to take it.
Well, so I actually come from an Anabaptist community.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay, cool.
This story is kind of part of our DNA in a way. Of course, I had to read a lot of other, you know, history, you know, more general history about the Reformation. We were also looking for like interesting, just things that visually would make the book interesting. So finding out about how did people actually live, what would Suresh have been like in 1525, you know, what would have been people's concerns, you know, which we would not necessarily find out from the primary sources relating directly to this story. So, you know, crime and punishment, like how did that's kind of probably the most interesting part is how they dealt out justice back then.
Or justice, air quotes.
Yeah.
what they said to justice.
There's a fascinating book called Diary of an Executioner. It was actually a real diary of a guy who that was his job, was dealing out punishment, not just killing people, but torturing people. And he would write down what he did and how he felt about it. And
wow.
So that was like a really fascinating sort of read. You know, these people weren't trying to be cruel. They really felt like they were doing God's work by, you know, by punishing people in this way, often in very, you know, horrific ways. So yeah, so there was a lot of background work that went into the story that you're not going to see, but I think was really important in how the product, how the book ended up looking.
Yeah, and were there things that you, again, as the script writer, had to say to Jason, can't fit this into the story? Sorry, man.
Yeah, so we started a lot more ambitiously, at one point I was like, you know, Jason, we are not Dostoevsky. You know,
we have editors.
Well, we have to have a basic storyline, you know, that people can follow. And, you know, we're trying to do this in 120 pages. So we probably can't have multiple threads, as fun as that would be. And maybe we'll have to like take some of this great material, which is great material, and save it for later in the trilogy. But I think we did a good job with the story we did choose, you know, and I think getting to the heart of who this guy was, who Felix Mantz was, what motivated him, and that was a really exciting process, just to sort of distill all the great material Jason gathered.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to start. So you said you come from an Anabaptist community, and this is not something that everybody is super familiar with. So I would love. I mean, I think it's important for people to understand. And again, I know you go into it in the book. So again, read the book, people.
Yeah.
But this isn't spoiler town. No. But I still think we need to know a little bit about what that means, because people don't hear that term often. The idea of rebaptizing, like people, that's something they're like, what is that? You know, depending. Mm-hmm. And again, it's you know what you know. If you're not Christian at all, you're like, baptism's weird. And if you're raised in a certain particular sect of Christianity, you're like, well, you do that once. Like I was raised Catholic. I'm not, like I said, I'm not that anymore. But like as a Catholic, You do that when you're a baby. You don't get a choice in that. You're like born, they baptize you, and that's it. You're that. And then the rest of your life, they tell you you're that. And you're like, I was 4 days old. What do we do? What?
I had no choice.
I didn't know what you're saying. So that is part of, obviously, that's part of the conversation here. So I guess explain to the folks, because I think it's important, what that is, and then how Felix comes into it. Again, this is his story, and spoiler alert for everybody, this story is 1,500 years old, so he's not alive still.
No,
just in case you wonder. No, but so don't get, you know, without giving too much away, but I do think it's important just to set the scene for, you know, this faith, this sect of Christianity, and who he was. So take it away, as much as or as little as you want to tell.
Okay, so I mean, actually, this is a really, really fascinating period in history. 1,500 in Europe, right? 1,500s in Europe. So you just have a lot of upheaval at the time. Obviously, the Bible's been translated. People are beginning to, read the sources. You have Thomas More has published his Utopia. There's a lot of thinkers putting out what at the time sounded like really crazy ideas. And so Felix is born in this time in Zurich, and he's the son of a priest, you know, so priests are not supposed to be married, so he's a bastard, and he's raised by his mother Anna, and
who may or may not be a prostitute, but boy, they sure treat her that way.
They treat her pretty badly.
Yeah, yeah. Goodness. Yeah.
So he grows up without a dad, and this ends up being kind of a big theme in his life. He's looking for someone who can be like a father to him. So at the time, Zurich is this very Catholic city, and one of its things that it's famous for is exporting mercenary soldiers, right? The Pope hires the Swiss soldiers to fight his wars for him, which is why you'll still see Swiss guards in the Vatican today, right? So that becomes kind of an issue later on. And so this is the environment Felix grows up in. He goes to Latin school. Somehow he gets a scholarship to go to Paris to study. And we're pretty sure this is where he meets a friend of his, Conrad Grebel, who ends up playing a pretty significant role later on. And that's where he studies a lot of these thinkers and really gets thinking. He goes back to Zurich. And what's happening in Zurich at that time is there's this reformist, there's this priest who's reforming the city. His name is Urs Zwingli, and he's basically just making a big stir. You know, he's not doing things the normal way. He's just reading from the Gospel of Matthew every week from the Bible. Instead of reading in Latin, he would read it in the vernacular. And he gathers this group of young men together to discuss theology and the new humanistic learning. And Felix is one of those young men. And so they're talking about things like, becoming free of the church control, things like mandatory fasts and, hiring out mercenaries. They're saying, like, why should we do this? This is wrong. The Pope shouldn't be controlling what goes on in their city. Let's make this city something different. So that's happening. But Urs Zwingli is ultimately, he wants to not take it too far. Like, he still wants to be able to have the respect of the local government and to stay in control. And so he only wants his reform to go so far. And Felix Mantz and his friends, they say, no, we started this thing by reading the sources, by reading the Bible and what it says about how to live. And we're going to just take this thing all the way. And one issue that becomes important for them is the question of baptism. So in the Catholic Church, infants are baptized, right? And that's a way of bringing them into the church. And also, there's an economic consideration, because once you're on the church rolls, you have to pay tithes, and there's nothing voluntary about it. Felix Mantz and Conrad Grebel and their other friends, they say this is wrong. This is this is not what the Bible talks about. Like, it should be, baptism should not be coerced. Membership in the church, faith should not be a matter of coercion. It should be free willing. And they end up getting into conflict with Ulrich Zwingli and the city council. And there's a public debate. And ultimately, these dissenters are given 8 days to baptize their infants. And if they refuse, they'll be banished. And what do? They do not capitulate. They go on and get baptized. They say, you know what? Our baptism as infants didn't count. We are going to be baptized as adults, and we're going to live how we feel is right. And so they did that. And the response was swift and brutal. Ulrich Zwingli, who had at one point been like a father figure, he sicks the council on these guys. And after 2 years, Felix Manz is captured and drowned in the Limmat River in Zurich, one of the first of many Anabaptist martyrs. So that's kind of a summary of the story. Hopefully not too much, but
again, it's not like this is all out there. Anybody can.
Oh yeah,
this guy. Yeah. So, but the way you guys are telling it, is very humanistic, and the fact that you've chosen to do it as a graphic novel instead of just writing a book, I think adds a layer of. And I'm a character first writer. I'm a writer. And I think character matters. And so I feel like it's important that you guys picked Felix as your character for the first part of the trilogy. And when I say character, obviously he was real, everybody, but he's still the character of this story. Because he's a guy, you know, of the other characters that you've introduced and the ones you've talked about here, Rich, he's the one who, it makes sense. We want to follow him, right? He's a rebel with a cause. Like, you know, there's all kinds of followers. Especially during this time, during the Enlightenment and during the Reformation, as you mentioned, there's a ton of followers. There's a ton of like, I've got a great idea. And you're like, hooray, great idea. And you know, they capture this perfectly in the life of Brian, Monty Python's Life of Brian, right? This whole idea that it's so easy to swing. Like then they have that big fight about the Judean People's Front, the People's Front of Judea. And you're like, you're saying the same things, but because you're like, no, we're called something different. So we're totally different because we're following this different thing. And so I love that you picked a guy who is a thinker. He's like, no, I hear you. And I am turned on by your idea. My mental faculties are engaged, but now I'm allowed to think for myself as opposed to just, and so I think that's what was an interesting choice that you picked him as opposed to, if you're telling a different version of the story, you pick a different lead character, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in Switzerland to this day, like Ulrich Zwingli is still sort of held up as the founder of the state or whatever. He's really looked up to as a hero. Still, yeah. There's statues of him all over the place.
Right. And how many statues of our man here? Probably very few.
I don't think any.
at the bottom of the river.
There is a plaque. There is a plaque by the river where he was drowned.
Wow. They're like, so we drowned some dude.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, it is what I, okay. So, You talked about how it's so relevant. So I appreciate that. And I think it's so true. It is so relevant. And I think we're constantly having a conversation that I don't know that we need to keep having. And it's so frustrating to read a book like this. Not that the book itself is frustrating. I don't mean it. I think it was good. I'm glad I read it. But to read this and be like, wow, look at how far we've not come. So as the writer of this book, you were obviously, and I know this is the wrong word, but the only word that's coming to mind is you weren't trying to be super preachy, but you were also trying to get a point across. And so what was that line to walk? Because again, we'll definitely get into like the modern place that we're in with this idea of being a thinker and being allowed to have your own thought and the state. And when I say the state, that can mean you're literally your county, your state, your government, your country, whatever the state means, your mom. Whatever, telling you no, but like, how important was it to you, like, to come across as like, here's the point, but also we're not trying to beat you over the head with it? Because I think you walk a really good line here, because you do manage to show all of it. Like you're saying, obviously in Switzerland, this guy's a hero, but you show him as the villain, but he's not like a mustache twirling villain. You're showing his reasons for doing what he did.
He's very conflicted.
Yeah.
Well, and that, I think that's also very true to who these people were, right? They were not, you know, in some ways you can say, look how far we have not come. But these people, you know, were people who were not trying to have it over on other people. You know, they weren't trying to like create revolution in the country. They were saying this has to be something that starts at the grassroots. This has to be something that's completely voluntary. And we are not, and this is a key point of this, of the Anabaptist conception is it's complete nonviolence, non-resistance. They refused to, they refused to defend themselves when they were attacked. And unlike the Catholics and the different Protestant groups, yeah, they were insistent that their faith told them that, you know, resist evil with good. And that's what they were going to do. And they were going to do it. They were going to live it. They were going to make this life for themselves. They weren't trying to like force other people to do it, which a lot of people will look at him. So a big part of Anabaptism is sharing everything, you know, sharing of wealth and resources. And people can look at that and say, oh, it's socialistic, communistic, you know, horrible, horrible. The big difference is they never forced, I mean, they were never about forcing other people to share stuff. They said, we're going to do this. We're going to build this society. We're going to build this type of life together. And, you know, if you like it, you can be part of it, but we will never compel anyone. So I think that's kind of the sense in which we tell the story as well. People can choose to live differently. People do not need, actually should not be forced to do anything that you know, does not come from their heart.
Right. And I think that's beautifully said. And I think this is the origin of, and because you mentioned utopia, of course, so Thomas More comes up too with the founding of this country and then the French Revolution as well. It all stems from this idea, this is literally the argument for the separation of church and state. This is it. They're saying, no. The government should have nothing to do with religion. The government should be about roads and buildings and whatever. You know, it's 1500s. There's no plumbing. There's not much for them to do. You know, keep us alive for as long as we can. That's the government's job. And our job over here is to do faith over here. Those two should not be connected. And it was, so it's fascinating to me to read this argument, a really cogent argument for the separation of church and state in the 1500s that we're still struggling with right now in 2023. It's insane to me that, again, look at how far we've not come, because for whatever reason, people can't grapple with that. And you guys don't, what I like what you don't do is you don't tell us, you don't give us the answer to that, because it's a hard thing. You're just like, I don't know, it's power, it's control, it's there for us to see. It's about, you know, the absolute power corrupting is what's happening here, and the using religion as a shield to do bad, and you said, as opposed to using religion to do good. So I think it's really an interesting story, because it doesn't matter what your religion is, because as you said, one of the creators is not a Christian, but found something compelling in this story that he wanted to be part of and tell, because again, he's, you know, I don't know. So I loved this story, but I was also just so bummed out. It's like, damn it. Why can't we figure this out 500 and some years later? And, you know, it's always been that way. We're still struggling with that. So, you know, and obviously I assume as this trilogy goes on, this idea will still be considered. So do you think everybody's going to see it, or is your concern that people are going to read this and unfortunately see the thing they want to see in this, as opposed to the message that's really there? Because obviously they missed the point then. We're still missing the point, especially hearing that in Switzerland, the wrong guy is the hero.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty confident people will see what they need to see in the book. And you know, mostly I hope it's a inspiration for people to learn more about this time period. That's what I see the power in a graphic novel is. It's a great place to start learning about something. You know, a big inspiration for me working on this project was Boxers and Saints, Gene Yang's graphic novel about the Boxer Rebellion. Mm-hmm. and how he took like a period of history which I knew something about, and then just made it so compelling, and then just made me want to go and learn a lot more about it. And I hope that's what this book does. You know, because as you learn more, I think it also because you learn more about the past, you know, it helps you think about the present, and helps you think about, you know, we actually don't have to accept, we don't have to accept the world as it is. These people sure as heck didn't, you know, that, you know, the easy thing for them to do would have been just go along, get along, but they said, no, we actually believe something else. You know, there's something bigger than just living our lives. There's greater possibilities, even if the cost is extremely high. And that's, you know, I think what we can learn from any, like, you know, true revolutionaries. You know, you look at in the past 100 years, the people who've made such a great impact on our world is people who've risked a lot, sometimes been killed for what they believe. You think of Oscar Romero, you know, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. You know, these are all people who they were happy, but they were also like happy warriors. You know, it wasn't until, you know, you look at Martin Luther King's last speech. He's like, I'm happy tonight, right? Because I can see something bigger. And I think that's what inspires me about this story. These are people who saw something bigger and were willing to go for it.
And what I love about it is it comes back to that choice situation. They are just wanting to be left alone. Now, like my part of Michigan, where I'm from, Amish everywhere, Amish, yeah, everywhere, yeah, yeah. And Amish. And you know, there, it's pretty cool because, you know, for the most part, I mean, there's always turds. There's always that, you know, like anybody who's seen the movie Witness.
Yeah.
That was not in Michigan, but you know, that was in Pennsylvania, but there's still those people who are awful to the Amish exist because there's awful people everywhere. But, the majority of the people where I'm from, you know, in my part of Michigan, in the northern Indiana area, they're like, cool. Those are pretty cool folks. You just like wave to them and you drive by and they wave back, they are just living and they're left alone. And the guy I went to college with is a physician in South Central Michigan. And he says, man, God, I love the Amish. They're my favorite customers. Cause you know what? They pay cash. They pay on time and they don't second guess me. When they call me, they are calling me because they're like, you're the expert. We're not, we don't know. So when they, you know, so it's like, there's this, so I think of them a lot and like, in reading this, cause they're not anybody who's pushing it on you. They don't even push it on themselves. Like, you know, every kid goes on a Rumspringa and then they get to choose. Like it's a choice. You go, they make you go out into the world for a year or two and live in the world. And then you choose to come back. And if you choose not to come back, it's all good. If you come back and then choose to leave, that's when things get bad. But they're like, we gave you this opportunity. And it's such a free, and it looks to the outside, being Amish looks like a really repressive thing. Well, maybe, but they're also giving everybody a choice. And it's not, they're really nonviolent. They're super mellow. So I could appreciate that when I was reading this, because I think it's all about perspective. It's easy to look at things and say, well, they're pushing that on me, but there's not anything in here. They're just saying, if you want to join us, you need to be like us, but you don't have to join us either. Yeah. And we're cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so great. And it's just, and again, I'm not trying to be a downer, but I just feel like there's an important lesson here that we keep missing. And so what is it? Is it part of the discourse? Is it just power? Is power and control still the problem as it was back then, that people say, in order to be in power, I need to rule with the iron fist instead of, you know, a hug? Because that's what's happened here, obviously. It's crazy to me to say, like, you're going to kill somebody over this, but still say, like, I'm a good Christian, but I just killed that other Christian. You're like, what?
Why? Yeah. it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Yeah, so, I mean, the doctrine that Anabaptist Christianity is called the Two Kingdom Doctrine, right? Which I don't know if you're familiar with. But basically, there's two kingdoms on earth that do not share communion with one another. So there's, you know, worldly power, right? And, you know, it's necessary. Government's necessary to, like, keep things in order. But then, you know, for Christians, you know, we actually don't answer to that government. We make our own rules. We live the way we need to live. Not in the sense of, like, we're going to have crime and such amongst us. But those... that separation, I think, was key for these people in making sense of the world, because, you know, it was, that stuff is over here and what we're doing is over here, and they're very separate. And that, I mean, that's what you see with the Amish, you know, and so I think if we're looking to, you know, obviously, like politically, I don't know, hopefully we're not going down too much of a rabbit hole.
Wherever you want. I mean, that's the thing of my show. It's a deep dive show. And I feel like this is a political, I mean, and again, you guys have Mark Russell writing your blurb. Dude's a political dude, right? I mean, I don't think you can have a conversation about this. And it doesn't mean that we have to say, here's my politics, but I do think this is a political conversation. And I do think, unfortunately, still in 2023, religion is a political conversation, because I believe personally, there's a ton of people who hide behind their religion and use like their fakey, and it drives me crazy. And my problem with organized religion is never the religion, it's the people who are using it. I'm like, did you read that book that you're talking about? Because it's, if you did, and that's what this is, what cracks me up about this whole thing with the Anabaptists and, you know, the story we're learning here. It's like, if you just actually read the book that you're pretending that you read, you would see that you're wrong, but you didn't read it. Like, you're, any book you read, you can pick four lines out of and say them out of context and out of order and make it seem like anything. But if you read it in order, if you read it all, you can get the context. So
yeah,
as political or not, I don't want to force you into it, Rich. I mean, I feel like this is a very, that's why as soon as I read it, I was like, I want to talk. I want to do this because I want to have that conversation. I think you're asking us to, not whether necessarily you yourself, but I think this book is asking us to have that deeper conversation. So, and we're being, you know, regardless of where we fall, you and I, we're adults having a normal conversation, which again is what they want us to do, regardless of where, you know, you're not going to, I'm not going to be Anabaptist at the end of this conversation, but I want you to talk about it. I want you to tell me why it's important. And I like a lot of the things that they have to say. So, you know, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, the mantra for Anabaptists was sola scriptura, right? Only scripture. That's all we, what does the Bible say about it? What does the Bible say about justice? What does the Bible say about, you know, material wealth? What does the Bible say about violence? What does the Bible say about, you know, living a moral life, an ethical life? And these are the measurements that they use for their lives. They weren't interested really in other, and it was often very simple people. These were not like, I mean, Felix was college educated, obviously he studied in Paris, but many of these people were, you know, just common folks. I think that's also what's really inspiring about them is, you know, it was, this is not a movement of, you know, of nobility or the aristocracy. It was a movement of common people who often came from difficult backgrounds. And they found, you know, words of liberation in the gospel and, you know, a hope for, you know, we don't have to wait for, you know, another world after we die, you know, where everything's going to be okay. Like, we can actually like live these values out here and now. We don't have to wait for government to you know, make the conditions right, and that's where their inspiration came from. And so in some ways it's actually pretty simple. It was pretty simple for them. There was not a lot of, you know, political theory or like interest groups and such, which, you know, Zwingli kind of fell into. Like, he kind of realized where his, what's, you know, where his bread is being buttered and went with that. But these people said, you know, if it's not from the Bible, and it, you know, it doesn't reflect those values, then we don't want any part of it. And, you can do what you like to us. We're not going to, capitulate. So I would say that's very simply, the politics of this story.
And right. The politics of the story is politics are different from this. Are because like you said, there's not, as you're describing it, there's nobody, you're saying that's not our government. You're not saying, you don't pay your taxes and you're going to overthrow the government. You're saying like, yeah, of course I need to vote. I'm going to go vote for governor. I'm going to vote for mayor. I'm going to vote for president. Like, I care who my congressperson is. I care that my town has a library, but that is, faith has nothing to do with that. That is the community in which I choose to live, and to live in a community, we have to all get along of all faiths.
Yep.
But you're also saying like, it's also cool. And again, you guys are walking the walk here by having a Hindu be your artist. You're saying like, look, this is the point. You didn't convert him to draw your book. You're just like, dude, you're an amazing artist. And that's the point. And at no point in time was that the conversation. And at the end of the day, you're not like damning him to hell for that. You're like, that's on him, whatever. And he's saying the same thing about you. And can't we all just get literally, and I know it's such a simple thing, but literally, let's just all get along. And then we could live, like you guys could live in the same neighborhood and mm-hmm. send your kids to the same school. And just what you worship at home is different. And you are literally what they're saying here and what you're saying and what this book is saying is these are different things. And they're supposed to be different things. And again, what Mark does in Second Coming, which I don't know if you've read, which is brilliant, Mark Russell's Second Coming, you know, he has this whole conversation, you know, because Jesus comes back to earth and doesn't understand humanity. And there's like all these people like protesting with all these like hate things. And he's like somebody has the God hates gay people thing. And he's like, dude, that's not a thing. Where are you picking that up? That's not in. And so it's like so funny to have Jesus actually actively speak to like a bigot and be like, I don't understand why you're getting this. Because
that sounds amazing.
It's really funny. I mean, it's Mark Russell, so it's really rated R. If that's not your if you're not a fan of lots of swearing and I wouldn't recommend it. But I think it's hysterical. Second Coming. So he like God sends Jesus back to Earth to live with Mark Russell's version of Superman. He's called Sunstar. Uh-huh. And so you know, and then he's making the conversation that everybody always makes about Superman being a stand-in for Jesus anyway. You know, he's the Ubermensch, as he were. And so it's this really funny thing of them like trying to like an odd couple existence living together, and like Jesus is just trying to wander around of Earth as it is, and he doesn't understand it because he's like, why are you saying all these things that I said? I didn't say that. Where are you getting that? It's really funny. But it's also like very this conversation, you guys are just coming at it in a much more historical and less satirical take.
It's kind of like Grand Inquisitor, you know, Dostoevsky.
Yeah. 100%. Yes, 100%. And it's this, and I think it's worth having the conversation because I think we paint with a broad brush and always, where all blanks are blank, and it's part of the problem, right? And you said about, you know, how political, but it's like all blanks aren't blank. All Protestants aren't blank, right? This is the point of this conversation that we're having is you're saying, hey, we're not Lutherans. You know, we're not this, we're this. And it's we don't think, like it always blows my mind. It'll always blow my mind forever and ever when I see politicians being sworn in on religious documents. It always drives me crazy. I'm like, that's not your job. Like you're not being sworn in as Pope or like, you know, and I work for nuns, you know, and I don't know what their swearing in ceremony is when they officially, you know, like graduate from like the Dominicans, their OPs, right? So whenever they officially get that title, I'm sure there's some religious texts involved, of course, because you're a religious leader. But like if one of the sisters ran for mayor and I still don't even know if my sisters would be like, well, I'm not bringing that here. Like I'm bringing my faith here and my reason here. But I'm not that. Like, while I'm over here, I'm something different. So it always blows my mind. And I think this, again, this book really just drives that point home to me. Like, these are just different things. And your faith can guide you to a life in politics, but it should also make you realize that if you're governing all people, they're not all going to think the same thing as you. And this is just a conversation here. Yeah.
The Anabaptists would say, no, you can't.
Oh, really? Okay. Awesome.
No, you can't. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to be in a position of, they would say, where you're wielding the sword of authority.
Oh, okay.
So you're not allowed to be a judge. You're not allowed to be a police officer. You're not allowed to be a soldier. You're, you know, not allowed to sit on a jury. You're not even allowed to swear oaths. So you're really.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You're really separate. So
it's just, you just live in the community, but then you're not. What about like a teacher?
Oh yeah, you could be anything that's serving people, but anything where you have authority over other people, where you could possibly be sitting in judgment.
Oh, okay. People, wow. That's awesome.
That's completely out from the Anabaptists. And again, that speaks to the two kingdoms doctrine, right? So this kingdom of power and government authority does exist and has its role to punish evil and to sort of keep the trains running and what have you, but it's completely different from what the Anabaptists would call the kingdom of God, you know, where God is actually ruling things.
Nice.
They're a whole different set of values is going to be playing out.
Right. As it should. And I think that's actually pretty fascinating. I find that refreshing to say, like, we're not going to bring that in. And probably their argument would be, right, it's like, it's hard to separate those things. Like if your job, like if you, their point is we don't want to coerce you to join us. So if I'm the mayor, even if I'm not saying it out loud, just the fact that I'm the mayor, it could be interpreted that to get good in with the mayor, you got to join my team.
Right.
And so they don't want that seeming impropriety.
Right. Well, yeah. I just think any involvement at all with it. I mean, a big part of their thing was separation from the world. It's called from what they called the world, meaning you know, government, and they just wanted no part of it.
It's just very communal, like you said, and it seems like a communist thing. But you know, there's again, that's just a word that has been you know, altered in the wrong way, right? Like.
Right.
When you read, like, you're like, oh, communism is bad. You're like, yeah, everybody getting along and living together and sharing. And that sounds awful.
Yeah.
But because it's, and the problem is always the people who use it, right? When you think communism and you're like, well, Xi Jinping is not a communist, really. Xi Jinping is not really a communist. Stalin wasn't really a communist. Like,
no.
They're using that word the wrong way. And so then the rest of the world thinks it. It's the same thing with your story. The word radical, this, I want to just bring this up. And I know we're, as I'm looking at the clock and boy, this time has flied. This has been great, Rich. I really have appreciated
this has
you
been very fun.
Having this conversation with me. The word radical comes up in here, like radical reformation. And I wanted to ask about that, the choice of that word. And I know it's probably historically accurate, but again, words have power. I'm an English teacher. Obviously this is a story about words having power. And, everything. So how do you think, and I know you can't be there, but how do you think, is that a word that they used, or is that a word that was used about them? Would they have considered themselves radical reformationists, or is that a term that has been placed on them? Because again, I'm only thinking of the word radical through this lens, and I don't really know how the word radical was used 500 years ago. So I'm just curious about that. I know you're like, really, one word, all this?
No, I don't.
200 page book, dude, and you're gonna write about one word? I'm just curious.
So it's, you know, it's an important point. I don't think they would have thought of themselves as radical. They wouldn't have even thought of themselves as Anabaptist. That was a name other people gave to them. It means one who baptizes again.
Right.
They called themselves followers of the way. They saw that there is a way to live, and they wanted to follow that way. I don't think they would have considered themselves radical at all. I think, again, these are simple people who, you know, wanted to live out the values that they read in the Bible, and would do whatever it takes. So that's what makes them radical. That's probably why this branch of the Reformation is called the Radical Reformation.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating use of the word. And again, I know it's time. Words mean something different, right? Obviously, booty used to mean pirate treasure. Now
right.
It means something else. So all those things are the case, right? I understand. But I that word kept, as I was reading this, you know, I read it again last night in preparation, and I was like, well, I just would have been remiss to not ask.
It's a good question.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because I think words have power. I think when people go like, oh, it's just semantics. No, let's have the semantic conversation. Because if we have the semantic conversation, then we're going to get through it to the other side, and we're all going to be fine. It's when we don't have it, and it's like, well, I think you mean this. You called me a radical. And you're like, oh, no. Like, because, you know, I was born in the 70s. So from the 80s, radical was good, right? In the 80s, rad was totally rad. But but radical now, like if you're calling somebody a radical in 2023 or in 1523, it meant something different. And just, you know, words have a life cycle, and they mean something different. And they mean something different in the way they're coming out of your mouth, too. Like
right,
if you talk to a baby or a dog in a tone, it doesn't matter what the words are. They're going to think you're mad at them or you're happy at them. Even if like, you're such a terrible dog, it's going to be like, yay.
Yeah.
Cause tone matters, but words matter. And so, I do. It's just, it's funny because, you know, obviously the saying that Napoleon said, you know, the winner's right. The history. Well, that is true. And so I think it's important that you guys are not rewriting history, but retelling history from the loser's perspective, as I'm air quoting losers, because these crazy radicals, we have to kill them and throw them in a river. I'm like, okay, you're throwing people in a river.
Mm-hmm.
That seems pretty radical. That seems like extreme to me. They didn't harm you. They didn't raise their hand in anger. They didn't harm a person. They didn't do anything. They did everything you asked them to do, except you couldn't leave them alone, but they're the radicals. So bizarre. But like you said, there are statues of this guy in Switzerland, and he's the one calling them radicals. And so
I think what makes them radical is that they were the reformers who really changed the terms of the debate, right? So the Protestant reformers would, you know, it was just a matter of shifting a couple things, right? And I mean, probably some good reforms that needed to happen. There was a lot of corruption in the Catholic Church.
Of course.
But then you had the Counter-Reformation, and you know, there were excesses on both sides, but this was the one branch of the Reformation that truly Well, very simply, this is the one branch of the Reformation that didn't kill other people.
Right.
Everybody
exactly.
Everybody else killed other people.
Well, and still, I mean, like you think of like the troubles in Ireland, the troubles, call a civil war, a religious war. It's not even a civil war. To call a religious war the troubles. Wow. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, let's words matter there. That is a religious war against each other for believing the same things. And Jim Gaffigan, of all people, you know, who's a Catholic, he's always like, I never understood that. See those people over there who look exactly like us and believe almost the exact same thing? We should kill them.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? But you're right. It is true. Like it's always easy to scrub that. Like the Crusades weren't good. They're like, I'm going out of crusade. No, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad. Yeah. You shouldn't use that term to mean that you're doing something that you think will end up positively, because the Crusades were all bad. We should quit using again, but words they matter. And so it always cracks me up when people say, I'm out of crusade. I'm like, oh, are you just gonna kill everybody who disagrees with you along the way? And they don't think that's funny. You did, so I appreciate that. But most people don't laugh at that joke because they don't think that's funny. But I do, because I mean it's horrible. I'm not laughing at the death, but I mean it's just like the way that words matter. So I just think this is great. I'm glad. This is coming out. So the first book comes out either a few days after or a few days before the show comes out. And then what's the plan for the trilogy? And do you like working with Plout? Like, this is my first time with them. So what do you, you know, like just a little bit behind the curtain with this production company, what's the plan for the rest of the trilogy? Do you like them? Would you want to work with them again?
Yes, we plan to keep the same. It was just a very happy partnership, and we'll hopefully be bringing the next ones out probably a year from now is the hope. So
okay, they're in production.
They're in production, but
they're in,
you know,
so they're in, say his name again because I don't want to. Sanka's hand.
Sanka Banerjee. Yeah.
Sanka. Yep, they're in Sanka's hand. The scripts are okay. So that's what in production means. Everybody listening to this show is a comic nerd. They're like, we get it. You're like, the writers are done, and it's like, okay.
Now the real work begins.
He is so good, by the way.
He is. He's amazing.
Did he color too?
Yeah, he and a bunch of his friends. Everything by hand is. I saw some photos of his apartment when they were doing the. It was like five guys just on the floor, working
I'm
together.
It was honestly wild. Just the first. Okay, so everybody, when you get your copy of this, which there'll be links in the show notes, how you can buy this. But like, so it starts as a cover page, which is gorgeous, and then there's just by water, and there's like it's black. You think it's just black, but you should spend time on that page, and then the next two panels. Are like you should buy prints of those and hang them on your wall. Those, I mean, one of them is terrifying, but honestly,
the pregnant lady.
Yes, good Lord, that is amazing. I was just like blow because I have the digital copy, so I'm like blowing it up. I'm like, what is going on in there? He is so good. I mean, you might like for the rest of your life, you'll be like, hey, I know that guy.
Yeah,
he's a friend of mine. I worked with him, and whatever else he puts out, you're like. I knew him first. I knew him. Everybody's going to see this and be like, I got to get on that. So it'll be a year for book two and then another year for book three.
That's what it seems like at the moment.
And what is book two? Who's our subject?
He's a guy called Jakob Hutter who ended up starting the first sort of Christian socialist community in the 1530s. And it's called By Fire.
Oh, right. I get it. Ha ha. Nice. Very good.
So there's this early Anabaptist teaching where we got the titles from, where they're talking to prospective members and they say each should first count the cost carefully as to what he has to give up, but he should not counsel with flesh and blood. For those who would enter God's service must be prepared to be attacked and to die for the truth and for the name of Christ, if it be God's will, by water, fire, or the sword. So that's the trilogy, by water, by fire, and by the sword.
Nice.
We'll see what those stories end up looking like, but they should be really interesting.
They should be. And again, it's the theme, right? I mean, I do think it's, again, I think socialism and communism, they get a bad, I mean, I'm a teacher. I teach for, a college. So it's a little bit of a different situation, but, you know, I do believe education needs to be available to people. And I, you know, my, one of my, our kids is a public school teacher. My wife's a librarian. Like, They're very like, I like that my roads, I was on the road today, you know, and that was something that we all get to use. Like, socialism is not a dirty word. And when everybody's like socialists, you're like, oh, okay. Did you pay the toll when you crossed the road this morning? Yeah, you didn't. Yeah. Oh, right. I forgot, because that part of socialism you like, but it's crazy. So I think it'll be fascinating. And, you know, so in a year we'll talk again and we'll talk about the next one. And I would love to do that, because I think it's an important conversation to have, because again, I know it's a book about, you know, religion, but it's not preachy at all. It's you're showing somebody something and saying, you're welcome to this point of view, but we just want the place to have the point of view, to share the point of view, because we weren't allowed, you know, these men and women weren't allowed 500 years ago, but now we live in a place where we are allowed to say it. You can read it or not read it. You can be Christian or not Christian, but I think there's a story to have there, because it drives me crazy when I hear somebody say, like, you know, a small government and freedom, but don't do this. Like, which is it? You can't say small government and freedom, but if that business owner during the pandemic said, I want everybody who comes in here to wear a mask, it's my business, and my wife has autoimmune disorder, but I need my business to be open. You can't tell that person, no, because we're a free state, you can't have a mask mandate. Well, that's not freedom. Then they're saying, I own the business, I can set my own rules. That's what freedom is. So you're like, how is one sentence so counter-opposed? And so I think it's always a fascinating conversation to have. It's like, when you're stifling voices, that's never good. And so this is about having those voices. And so I appreciate it. This is great. Thanks, man. I really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun talking.
It has. And this is my, like I said, as I told you before we started recording, my class has been studying Thomas Aquinas and Erasmus of late. And, Erasmus, obviously, the rapscallion of the Reformation, he's hysterical. And I made them read Praise of Folly. And they were, you know, that's hard. I don't know if you've read that. That's heavy lift language wise, but he drew pictures too. So it's like one of the first graphic novels too, which is kind of funny, right? But he's also like, here's this funny thing. But that really helped them read Erasmus. But again, he was saying the same thing. He's like, let's not take everything so seriously. And maybe these things aren't our whole lives. Let's just accept what you accept and then like quit fighting about it. Let's just live. So it's fascinating. So this is great. So if you have anything, you'll send me links. I've got all your stuff from Hannah that I can link to the pre-order or the post-order, depending on when the show comes out. But like, you in particular, are you anywhere on the internet that you'd like people to find you?
I personally am not on any social media.
Okay. Smart man.
But you can definitely follow the book's progress on the publisher's Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, I guess is where they all are.
Yep. And I've got the links from Hannah. They'll be right in the show notes there. I think that's smart of you. I was off social media for a while, but see, you're here on my show now, and see, I have a book coming out in May, and that was the deal. They're like, hey, if we're going to publish your book, you got to get on those things and be out there talking about it. So I have an Instagram and Facebook now, because those are the rules.
I think Sanka has an Instagram, and he's definitely worth following. He posts some really interesting stuff out there.
Okay, well, I'll put his link in there, because boy, his art, this is my first time encountering him, and I need to know more. I need to see more of his work. So I will definitely give him a follow. Well, cool. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Hannah, for putting this together. And of course, my website, everybody, arfarina.com. You can sign up for whatever, all my stuff. You can reach me. I've got email links to all the stuff. That's my website. So that's the best place to reach me, and obviously the show. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Rich.
Thanks so much.
All right. We'll see everybody next time. Thank you.
Thank you.